In my humble judgment, there's two tremendously outstanding experiences that we're privileged to have on this campus. One is shared by the faculty, and that's when our president delivers his annual message to that group. And the second is when he appears before the faculty and the student body of this great institution and delivers the message at our first devotional, his message at our first devotional assembly. You've had the opportunity to read important information concerning the life and experience of our president, which appeared in the universe yesterday morning. So that I will not encroach on his time, I urge you to read that to become better acquainted with his work. And at this time, it's my pleasure to give you President Ernest L. Wilkinson.
My brothers and sisters, I feel altogether inadequate this morning to give the kind of address I should like to give. I trust, therefore, all the more that I may have your faith and prayers that I may say something that will be of benefit. I want, first of all, to express the gratitude, our gratitude to our Heavenly Father for the safe arrival on this campus this fall of all students, when we have approximately 10,000 students coming from all over the country, mainly in automobiles. Great hazards are involved, and we're grateful that, so far as we know, there has been no serious accident this year. There have been occasions, both in coming to the campus and in going, when we've had several students killed. May we plead with you at this time that you be careful in driving during the school year, that we will have no serious incidents of any kind. I was at the Mazur building last night about 10 o'clock. You know, we have straightened the roads on both sides, made them more navigable, and I was just a little concerned last night to find many students opening up the throttle, driving around on the campus here two and three times, four and five times the speed allowed on our campus. May we urge you to have proper restraint so that we'll have no accidents this year. I'm happy to report to all of you that as of last night, we had a registration of 9,988 students. It's now evident that we will have over 10,000 students for this fall term. With those who will be admitted during the winter and spring terms, we will have approximately 12,000 students on the campus this year. Last year, we had approximately 1,500 veterans. Because not so many men are being called in the service, we do not expect as many this year, but we expect a total during the year of around 1,200 veterans. Last year, we had on our campus over 2,100 return missionaries. We expect just as many and probably more return missionaries this year. Last year, we had on our campus 3,027 students who transferred here from other institutions of higher learning, coming altogether from 386 other institutions of higher learning. 26 of these institutions were located abroad. 245 represent senior institutions and 117 junior colleges in the United States. This unusual number of transferee students results from the fact that they desire to finish their education at their church university, where their secular and their religious training may be blended in a spiritual union. With 1,200 veterans, over 2,000 returned missionaries, and over 3,000 students who will be on our campus this year, having transferred from other institutions of higher learning, because they desire to have their testimonies as well as their intellect strengthened, We have a student body the like of which does not exist on any other campus. And we congratulate you on being a part of that great student body. I wish to thank each of you, about 4,000, who gave me the privilege on Friday and Saturday of last week on shaking hands with you as you came through the registration lines. You gave me inspiration and incentive to carry on in my position at this university. I want you to know that I love you for what you are and for what you aspire to be. And I hope that I may have the opportunity during the year of again shaking hands individually with not only the new students to the campus, but those who have been here in previous years. There was only one aspect of my greeting of the students that I did not like. When I came to the university some 8 years ago, many of you, as I shook hands with you, would say, "My father or my mother wants to be known, knows you and wants to be remembered to you." This year, for the first time, many of you said, "My grandfather or my grandmother knows you and wants to be remembered to you." I just want you to know that if your grandfather or grandmother knows me, it's because they knew me as a youngster, because I'm not as old as they. I hope the faculty will be patient and tolerant with what I say this morning, because most of them have heard parts of it at least before. My justification is that 75% of the students have not heard it, and at least 25% of the faculty, because we've engaged that many the last 2 years. I ask the faculty to be tolerant in the second place, because I know that they repeat the same courses every year, sometimes 2 and 3 times a year, and I take license from that. It was just 115 years ago that a young Scotch boy was walking down the streets of one of the important cities in Scotland, and he saw in glaring headlines the story or the news release of the killing in the United States of Joseph and Hiram Smith, who had been martyred because of their devotion to a religious cause. This young Scotch boy, William Budge, had never before heard of Mormonism, but he was so incensed and so indignant that in the free country of America, men would be murdered because of their religious belief, that he immediately determined that he would find out what Mormonism was all about. In a very short time, he had an opportunity to hear the elders on a street corner in one of the cities in Scotland. He studied, and in a very short time was baptized a member of this church. And even while he was in his teens, before he was of age, before he had ever been to America, he was called on a mission to England. Just about the same time that this young man had been called on a mission to England, maybe 1 or 2 years later, a young German educator of about the same age, in his early 20s, who lived in Saxony, realized that the education which he had received in Germany was lacking. He thought that he needed to know more about life, its purposes, the controlling motivations of the universe, and about God. At that time, he came across a very critical article written by a man by the name of Bush, attacking the Mormons in the United States. Rather, however, than prejudicing this young man against Mormonism, he decided that that was a philosophy that he wanted to study. But since there were no Mormon missionaries in Saxony, never had been, He wrote to President Van Cott of the Danish mission, whose name he had happened to see in one of the German newspapers. President Van Cott replied, stating that he could not speak German, and suggested that this young German write to President Tyler of the Swiss and German missions. Young Maser, this German investigator, did just that. President Tyler's associates, however, in Switzerland were somewhat frightened at this letter. They knew that the Prussian police were in control of the situation in Saxony. They suspected that this was some kind of a ruse to obtain or to get a Mormon elder to come to that place where he would be imprisoned by the Prussian police. And at their suggestion, President Tyler, instead of answering the inquiry of young Maser, sent it back to young Maser without even an acknowledgement of any kind. President Tyler made the comment at the time that if this young man were real serious, he knew he would write again. When young Maser in Germany or in Saxony received this letter, he was indignant. And therefore, he sent a curt letter again to President Van Cott in the Danish mission, asking the reason for this strange procedure. President Van Cott, in turn, sent a letter of apology to young Carl Maser and told him he had forwarded his second letter again to President Tyler of the Swiss mission. When he received that letter, President Tyler then knew that young Maser was sincere and in earnest. And accordingly, extensive correspondence ensued between them. Brother Maser later wrote that although at the time he had no faith in God, or in the Bible, or in religious doctrines, he soon realized that Mormonism was something bigger than he had even anticipated. He therefore expressed a desire in one of his letters to President Tyler that a young missionary be sent to Germany to tell him about the gospel. And he said he didn't want an ordinary missionary. He wanted someone who really knew the subject so that he wouldn't be wasting his time. President Tyler forwarded this request to President Franklin D. Richards, president of the European Mission, with offices then in Liverpool. Appreciating that young Maser wanted a real missionary, President Richards looked around and decided that the best prospect to qualify under those terms was this young Scotch missionary, William Budge, who had never been to America. And he asked young Budge if he wanted to go. He did not make it an assignment. There were hazards involved. No one had ever been to Saxony. The Prussian police were brutal. And it was not at all beyond the possibilities that he would be imprisoned. But even though he did not make it a call, young Budge decided to go. And he thereupon started an exchange of letters with young Maser. Young Maser invited him to his home in Saxony, and in order that they could identify each other when they met, they exchanged through the mail a kind of zigzag puzzle of two parts. Young Budge kept one part, sent the other to Brother Maser. And when young Budge finally arrived in Saxony and met Brother Maser, they put together this zigzag puzzle, which served as an introduction to each other. Young Budge brought with him a Bible. One column of each page was printed in English, the other in German, because Brother Budge did not know the German language. With this as a beginning, young Maser taught him enough German so that young Budge, in return, for they were of the same age, could teach him the gospel. They lived together. Brother Budge had to report to the Prussian police every morning and every night. It was not long until young Maser asked to be baptized. Learning that President Franklin D. Richards of the German mission was going to Italy by way of Germany, they decided they would wait until President Maser or President Richards came for this baptism. And when President Richards arrived, they went to the River Elbe, and there young Carl G. Mazur was baptized as the first convert to the Mormon Church in Saxony. Brother Mazur later wrote that as he came up out of the water and was about to be confirmed a member of this church, he prayed as he had never prayed before, that he be given an immediate testimony of the divinity of this gospel. And after his confirmation, they started to walk back to his home several miles distant. President Richards placed himself on one side of young Budge, Brother Mazur on the other side, in order that young Budge could translate or interpret the English of Brother Richards into the German of Brother Mazur. But no sooner had they started than both President Richards and Brother Budge said they did not need the intermediary of an interpreter, that they understood each other perfectly in each other's foreign language. And they walked back several miles, speaking animatedly, talking about the gospel, in particular the powers of the priesthood. And as they arrived at the home of Brother Mazur, this gift of interpretation of tongues left them just as quickly as it had come to them. And young Mazur, in consternation, turned to Brother Budge and said, "What does this mean?" And Brother Budge says, "Brother Mazur, that's the testimony which you prayed for when you were confirmed a member of this church." It was not long until Brother Mazur and his wife and child, together with his wife's sister, her husband, her two sisters, and her mother, applied for baptism. It was not long thereafter until they decided to leave Germany, which they had to do under cloak of darkness for fear they would be stopped by the Prussian police. When all of these families, however, got to England, they were again divided. Because there this time, Brother Mazur was called on a mission to Scotland, the country from which Brother Budge had already come. The rest of the families went on to Zion, Brother Mazur staying to serve his mission in Scotland. Later, when that had been completed, they set sail across the Atlantic. 2 days out of New York Harbor, one of their two children passed to his reward. And on July 4th, our national holiday, Brother Mazur and his wife arrived in New York Harbor to bury one of their children. They then trudged on to Philadelphia, where he ran out of money and sought employment in order that he might go to Zion. When he had saved up enough money to go to Zion, he was called on a mission for the second time, this time to Virginia. While on this mission to Virginia, as he afterwards often related, he often did not have enough to eat. Many times he would lay down by the side of the road and ask his missionary companions to go on and to leave him because he did not have the strength himself. But loyal to him, they always stayed with him. He afterwards related the story of one day going down the streets of Richmond, later the capital of the Confederacy. As a musician, he was prompted to go into a music store, where he found one clerk who could not even demonstrate a piano. A distinguished customer came in the store and wanted a demonstration. Brother Mazur, overhearing the conversation, volunteered to give that demonstration. And on the strength of it, the clerk sold the most expensive piano in the store. The customer immediately turned to Brother Mazur and asked if he could engage him to give piano lessons to his two daughters. It turned out that this distinguished customer was none other than ex-President Tyler of the United States. And with the money he received from these music lessons, he was able to finish his mission in Virginia. At the conclusion of that mission, he returned to Philadelphia, was made president of the Philadelphia Conference, held that mission until that position until 1860, when he had finally saved up enough money again to go to Utah. The Mazur family traveled in Patriarch John Smith's company, and the trip across the plains consumed 4 months' time. His lack of training in pioneer methods left him poorly equipped for the journey, and so he arranged to share a wagon with a young Englishman named Duke, who agreed to harness and hitch and drive the oxen, because Brother Mazur had had none of that training, and even when he came to Utah, didn't know how to do the most elementary pioneer things. On arriving in Utah in 1860, he set up a private school in Salt Lake City. There he eked out a bare existence teaching school for 7 years, during which time he taught the children of Brigham Young. In 1867, as he was seated in the tabernacle at a general conference of the church, he heard his name called from the platform as having been called on a mission to Germany, his native land. That was the only notice in those days that missionaries were given. And so, imbued with the spirit of this gospel, as he left home, he gave his wife the last 50-cent piece he had, and then left to go on this mission, traveling without purse and scrip. He was very discouraged. He was unable to convert any other of his relatives in Germany. And when he returned, his wife returned to him the 50-cent piece which he had given her as he left. She had prospered more while he was away than when he had been at home. Resuming his teaching in a ward meeting house, he also organized and taught the work of the first normal department in the University of Deseret, now the University of Utah. After 6 more years of teaching, he one morning discovered that the ward meeting house in which he taught his students had been burned. Rushing to Bishop Sharp of that ward, he found the bishop in the office of President Brigham Young. He rushed into the office and told them of the great tragedy. President Young looked at him and said in substance, "Brother Mazur, don't worry. We have another mission for you." Brother Mazur said that his heart just about dropped out of his boots at that time. He thought 3 missions had been enough. Besides, he didn't know how his family would be able to live. Finally, President Young made it a little easier by saying, "Brother Mazur, we want you to go to Provo to organize and conduct an academy to be established in the name of the church. That will be your mission. Will you come back and let me know in a couple of days whether you will go?" Brother Mazur didn't wait the couple of days. He came back immediately, told President Young that he was ready to go and wanted instructions. And having been educated in the Prussian educational system, he expected a long series of written instructions, but President Young turned to him, said, "Brother Mazur, these are your instructions. You ought not to teach even the multiplication tables or the alphabet without the Spirit of God. That's all. God bless you and goodbye." This distinguished German educator came to Provo, held his first class here in April of 1876. President Heber J. Grant said on more than one occasion, "If Brother Mazur had been the only convert we had ever converted in Germany, all the money spent in that mission would have been well spent." As I told you, on Monday of this week, the minutes of the first meeting record that Brother Mazur presided. He played the organ, he led the singing, and he gave the only speech. And he said, "I trust you all. I give you my confidence. I hope you will do nothing to weaken that confidence. I put you all on your word of honor." That short, meaningful address of Brother Mazur, given at the first assembly, I adopt as my text today. Later on in another address, Brother Mazur gave further definition by what he meant by honor. "My young friends," he said, "I've been asked what I meant by word of honor. I will tell you. Place me behind prison walls, walls of stone ever so high and ever so thick, reaching ever so far into the ground. Then there is a possibility that in some way or another I may be able to escape. But stand me on the floor and draw a chalk line around me and have me give my word of honor to never cross it. Can I get out of that circle? No, never. I would die first." These statements of Brother Mazur are basic to the philosophy of this institution. We trust all of you from the time you enter this institution and hope that you will never do anything to be found unworthy of that trust. Consistent with that philosophy, the Blue Key National Honorary Fraternity on this campus, with the intention of developing integrity and honor in every student, about 1948 began a movement to encourage the students to adopt their own honor code. This culminated some 10 years ago when the student body adopted an honor system as a part of the constitution of the Associated Students of the Brigham Young University. It is therefore a creature of the student body itself, designed to give vitality by the students themselves to the charge that Brother Mazur gave to the students in 1876. And because this is its 10th anniversary, I want to tell you about it today. The Honor Code of the University reads in part as follows. "We, the students of the BYU, in order to secure a more general adherence to our ideals and standards of personal integrity and social responsibility, do establish the following honor code. We take for granted that enrollment in this university assumes acceptance by the individual of the moral ideals and standards of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We feel it's an obligation to respect the personal rights of others in the use of university facilities, in our participation in school activities, and in our personal relationships with each other. We believe in the property rights of others, that they are sacred and should not be violated. Since we all share in the use of university grounds and facilities, we feel that it's our responsibility to respect and preserve them. We believe in a high sense of personal honor and integrity, that honesty must prevail in all academic work, that our lives can be enriched only to the extent that our academic achievement is the result of our own effort. We believe that adherence to these standards and ideals can be most effectively brought about through the establishment of an honor council selected by the student body. The honor code, therefore, today is the reaffirmation of the standards of conduct for BYU students stated in the catalog of this institution, which requires of every student the maintenance of standards of honor and integrity, of graciousness in personal behavior, and of an abstinence from the use of tobacco and alcohol. The student body realized, in the words of former President Eliot of Harvard University, that there are some things that the honorable man never does. He never wrongs or degrades a woman. He never cheats or oppresses a person weaker or poorer than himself. He never betrays a trust. He's always sincere, candid, and generous. Applied to our scholastic work, he never obtains any grade under false pretenses. He never accepts a degree knowing that it's the product of deception to which he's not entitled. The Student Honor Council charged with the administration of this code is composed of 16 students, appointed by a committee of which the Dean of Students and President of the Student Body are members. Generally, students from every class are appointed on this council. The chairman of this year's Honor Council is John Hunter of Pasadena, California. With William Anderson of Green River, Wyoming, and Robert Lees of Lakewood, California as vice chairman. All of these students, incidentally, are returned missionaries. Since not all of the other 13 members of the council have yet been appointed, I shall not mention the others who have. This student council is given concurrent jurisdiction with the dean of students to investigate all cases of academic and limited cases of non-academic misconduct of students at this university. The Honor Council then makes recommendations to the president of the university or his representative as to what should be done in each case. The Honor Code defines academic misconduct as that of giving, mind you, giving, or receiving aid in examinations, or in the preparation of individual work done in or out of the classroom, unless the instructor has specified that giving or receiving aid in a particular case is permissible. Examples of this misconduct are those of copying from some author without giving the author proper credit, of preparing a theme for someone else, of handing in as a theme someone else's product, or of plain cheating during examination. Summarily stated, academic misconduct means receiving academic credit under false pretenses. Your student code defines non-academic misconduct as consisting of any violation of Christian standards of proper conduct, including without limitation any infractions of personal honor, integrity, or morality, and any other conduct not in keeping with the standards and ideals of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, whether committed on or off the campus. Examples of this misconduct are acts of stealing which make you a thief, bearing false witness against another student, which in ordinary business practice might subject you to criminal prosecution, dishonesty in business dealings, which in ordinary life might also result in a penitentiary sentence, or failure to observe the single standard of morality, which under the Latter-day Saint Code is one of the greatest of mortal sins. Instances of dishonesty on a campus, we find, may take many forms, such as trying to get two meals on a cafeteria ticket, trying to beat a traffic ticket by claiming someone else was driving, signing a contract with the landlord for a room and giving a check in payment, therefore, and then canceling the payment on the check, the stealing of books or other property of another student. In this institution also, the use of tobacco and alcohol are moral offenses because they are injurious to our tabernacles of flesh, which we call our body. There are other offenses which are equally serious for one who claims to be a faithful member of the church which sustains this institution. I'm sure it's just as offensive to our Heavenly Father for us selfishly to refuse to pay a full tithing as it is for us to use alcohol. But because tithing records are confidential between the student and the bishop, this is one phase which the student council will not investigate. In practice, the student council generally confines its non-academic activities to cases of violation of the word of wisdom and obvious cases of dishonesty, in particular, apparent cases of stealing. The dean of students and his staff take care of the relatively few cases involving more serious offenses, such as cases of immorality, other sex offenses, and other serious crimes or sins. In this respect, may I say that degrading motion pictures, a great loosening of society's standards, and unfortunately, in some cases, life in the armed services, have resulted in a serious increase of homosexual practices in our society. In a student body of 10,000 members, we can probably expect to have a few of these perverted individuals. The Dean of Students has been given instructions this year that students who engage in any practices of this kind will not be tolerated on this campus. The procedure of the Honor Council is aimed at helping you as students to overcome your weaknesses rather than at punishing you to succumb to those weaknesses. Thus, if a student is reported for a first offense in committing an act of academic misconduct, a member of the Honor Council will interview that student. If he shows the proper attitude and the proper repentance, which means abstaining from any repetition of the offense, it may be that no punishment of any kind will be meted out except a warning or a reprimand. If, on the other hand, the student persists in academic misconduct, it becomes the obligation of the Honor Council to recommend to the Dean of Students appropriate action, which may be that of probation for misconduct, suspension for a given time from the university, or complete permanent expulsion from the university. A student on probation for disciplinary reasons may not hold any major student body office or participate in any activities representing the BYU, such as dramatics or intercollegiate athletics. He also is not eligible for any scholarship or financial grant in aid. In accordance with provisions of the Honor Code adopted by the students themselves, the faculty members will generally leave the room during examination. Unless the examination be of such a nature that questions may arise, and it would be helpful for the students, for the teacher to be on hand to answer such questions, or there be some other legitimate reason for the teacher being present. The examination may also be of such a type that the teacher may want to know how long it takes for students to answer the questions, and he may therefore stay around to see when students finish. Unless, however, there is some explicit reason for the teacher remaining in the room other than detecting cheating, we ask faculty members to leave the room and to trust the students to their honor. We urge faculty cooperation in this respect, for we know that the success of the system will depend on faculty cooperation. When the teacher does leave the room, you will be entirely on your own honor. And whether you are a person of character, integrity will then reveal itself. The tradition has grown up on this campus that if anyone sees anyone else cheating, he may rap his pencil on the desk, or he may discuss it with the professor, or he may refer the case to the Student Honor Council. You, as students, have these electives. Instances of non-academic cheating, such as violations of the word of wisdom or other acts of dishonesty, such as stealing, may also be reported to any member of the student council or to the staff of the Dean of Students. Instances of gross misconduct, including all acts involving moral turpitude, such as immorality or acts of sexual perversion, should be reported to the office of the Dean of Students. Matters of that kind are handled by a university standards committee composed of 5 members of the faculty and 2 students. Now, I am well aware that there's a natural instinct not to report on one's friends, that in certain stratas of our society there has grown up the false code that one ought not to rat on friends. Let me tell you why that code is inconsistent with the philosophy of this institution. It is repugnant to our thinking, first because it's the code of the underworld. It's the code of those who engage in prostitution, other forms of moral debauchery and crime of all description. It's their code because they have to protect each other from detection by officers of the law. Except for this code, there would not be the juvenile gang killings of which we read daily having occurred in New York City. But those who do not engage in crime do not need this protection and do not therefore need to subscribe to this nefarious code. It's repugnant to the thinking of civilized people in the second place, because an orderly society requires that good citizens report offenses against that society. If you saw someone committing a robbery, do you think that as a good citizen you should not report that to the police? If you saw someone stealing an automobile, would you be a good citizen if you sat by and made no report of it? If you saw a friend set fire to someone's house, would you be a good citizen to sit by and fail to report on your friend? If you knew that one of your friends had violated the chastity of your sister, would you feel that you ought not to rat on your friend? The very foundation and preservation of our society requires that the forces of good always report on the emissaries of evil. If in private and public life we do not report on the wrongdoings of others, there would be a complete breakdown in law enforcement, and this would be a very unsafe world in which we live. As applied to the BYU, the idea that we should not report on wrongdoers is bad for another reason. We are our brother's keeper, and if we have any who are weak, it is in their interest that they be reported so that they can be worked with in love and understanding and their evil tendencies corrected. A child who is disobedient has to be corrected. This is still true with those who are no longer in childhood. If we do not help our friends to overcome habits of wrongdoing early in life, we ourselves become parties to that wrongdoing. How can we be our brother's keeper if we are unwilling to report an offender in confidence to his friends on the Honor Council, particularly where you know that they are not going to be penalized unless they're obstinate in repenting, and where you know that every effort will be made in love and understanding to help them? Moreover, informing on academic offenders is necessary for your own academic reputation and standing. If you were competing for an engineering job and you saw that your competitor cheated in an examination by going to some book and copying from it, would it be fair for you to sit by and not report the wrongdoing of your competitor? I suggest it's equally wrong for you to sit by in a class and permit someone else to cheat or to help him to cheat when your comparative grades are going to be based on your relative performance in that examination. May I suggest, therefore, that you have the same student responsibility at the university as you have civic responsibility at home, even more so. And that for you to fail to report wrongdoing does not represent manliness on your part, but a lack of courage and a lack of respect for the standards of this institution. You will yourselves never grow to the stature of men and women if you fail to do your duty. The honor code on this campus is set by the students as a guide for your conduct in future life. Whether you will succeed or not will depend more upon your ultimate reputation for honesty than for your reputation for brilliance. We all learn very soon in life not to trust a man who's dishonest, even though he may be brilliant. In fact, if he's brilliant, that's all the more reason for our distrusting him. I'm satisfied that one of the basic reasons why Abraham Lincoln never became president of the United States was because of his reputation for honesty. His opponent, Stephen A. Douglas, had a much greater reputation for brilliance, but he was lacking in the fundamental prerequisite of honesty. Judge Douglas had been a great friend of the Prophet Joseph Smith, and on many occasions bore testimony to the integrity and ideals of the prophet.
When, however, the saints in Illinois became unpopular and it was politically popular for Douglas to denounce the saints, he did so. William Clayton, one of our saints who kept a faithful daily diary, recorded in his journal at one time that he had been to a dinner with Judge Douglas and the prophet. And at the end of that dinner, the prophet arose and, pointing his finger at Judge Douglas, said, "Judge, you will aspire to the presidency of the United States. And if you ever turn your hand against me or the Latter-day Saints, you will feel the weight of the hand of the Almighty upon you. And you will live to see and know that I have testified the truth to you. For the conversation of this day will stay with you through life." This prophecy was made some 17 years before Douglas ran for the presidency. It was published in the Deseret News in Utah in 1856, some 4 years before the election. In 1860, the Democratic Convention nominated Douglas as its candidate for the president. When he was nominated, no man in the history of American politics had no more reason to hope for success. The political party of which he was the leader had in the preceding election polled 60% of both the electoral and popular vote. That is an unusual high majority in this country. 3 years prior to his nomination, however, and 14 years after the interview with the prophet, Judge Douglas gave a speech at Springfield, Illinois, in which he urged that Congress repeal the organic law of the territory of Utah on the ground that the Mormons are alien enemies and outlaws, unfit citizens of one of the free and independent states of this Confederacy. After his speech, the Deseret News, in its issue of September 2, 1857, addressed an open letter to Douglas in which the news said, and I quote, "Inasmuch as you were well acquainted with Joseph Smith and his people, also with the character of our maligners, and did know that their allegations were false, but inasmuch as you must bark with the dogs who were snapping at our heels to let them know that you were a dog with them, and also that you may have a testimony of the truth of the assertion that you did know Joseph Smith and his people, and the character of their enemies, and also that you may thoroughly understand that you have voluntarily, knowingly, and of choice sealed your condemnation and damnation, and by your own chosen course have closed your chance for the presidential chair. Through disobeying the counsel of Joseph, which you formerly sought and prospered by following, and that you in common with us may testify to all the world that Joseph was a true prophet, the following extract from the history of Joseph Smith is again printed for your benefit and is candidly recommended to your careful perusal and most careful consideration." The Deseret News then printed the advice and warning which the prophet had given in 1843. When the electoral votes for president were counted that year, Douglas had the fewest votes of the four candidates who ran. In contrast to the dishonesty of Douglas, let me give you the example of an attorney, a great statesman and lawyer, for whom it was my privilege to work as a young lawyer. I worked in New York City in the office of the Honorable Charles Evans Hughes, who had been Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, Governor of the State of New York, ran for the office of President against Woodrow Wilson, and later was Chief Justice of the United States. When I was working for him, he was working on an antitrust case. The jury below had awarded a $6 million damages against his client. He was not the attorney in the case at that time. He was then engaged as the attorney to appeal the case. And so great was his honesty and integrity that when he argued the case before the Court of Appeals, he told the court that there was only one bit of evidence on a particular page in the 1,000 pages of the record that indicated any conspiracy of any kind to violate the antitrust laws. And being in the courtroom at the time, I remember that the chief judge who was hearing the case turned to Hughes and said, "Mr. Hughes, we respect your integrity and your honesty. If you tell us that's the only evidence in this record, then we only have to read one page of the record." And when the opinion of the appellate court was handed down some months later, they relied entirely on the statement of Judge Hughes and said that they had examined that evidence and that because of it not being sufficient to support the verdict was entirely reversed. In San Francisco, there is a very prominent publishing company by the name of Whitney Bancroft, which publishes a great many legal periodicals for the legal profession. Shortly after the turn of the century, the office and building of that particular company burned. The company had no record of the amount owed it by thousands of lawyers throughout the United States. Faced with this situation, the officers of the company wrote a letter to each of the lawyers with whom they had done business, stating frankly that their accounts had burned, that they did not know whether or not that particular lawyer owed them anything. But if he did, they would appreciate his paying his account. In due time, this company collected 102% of the total amount of all accounts outstanding at the time of the fire. With this income, this company constructed a new building, and on the front of the building are carved the words, "We serve an honorable profession." One of the boasts of this institution is that we aim to produce men of honesty and integrity. It was my privilege as a youngster in Washington, D.C., to know a former governor of this state by the name of William Spry, who had been greatly influenced by the life of Carl Mazur. When he became commissioner of the General Land Office in Washington, fountain pens were coming onto the market for the first time. The government supplied him with a fountain pen for his work at his desk, which he carried in his pocket during the day. But every night when he left his office, he took that pen out of his pocket and left it on his desk, for he told his office force that that was the property of the government and he had no right to use it for private purposes. In those days, he and his secretaries had an old manual press for getting out carbon copies of letters. And by the time Governor Spry would get through with his work for the day, he would have a purple ink on his hands. The government had a special kind of soap which could be used for taking this ink off his hands. One of his secretaries one day put a couple of bars of the government soap in Governor Spry's pocket so that he could use it at home. The governor did not notice these bars of soap in his pocket until after he left the building. But when he discovered them, he was several blocks from the building. He walked back, informed his secretary that these bars of soap were government property and that he had no right to use them except for the limited purposes indicated in the office. One of the great pioneers who loved the American Indian among our ancestors was Jacob Hamblin. He had the confidence of the American Indian in this part of the country to such an extent that they would take his word for anything, and when he traded produce with them, they allowed him to determine how much of their goods in return he would take. He would deliver certain produce to them for blankets. They never tried to barter with him. They would let him determine the number of blankets which he would get in return. Finally, when his oldest son grew up, one day he sent his oldest son down to visit some of the Navajo Indians and to trade some produce for blankets. The Indians asked the son how many blankets he wanted. They thought he was following in the footsteps of their father, so they were willing to trust him. The boy, however, took all of their blankets. He went home and with a great deal of ecstasy reported to his father about the great bargain he'd made. The father said, "Son, before you eat another meal, you turn around and take most of those blankets back to the Indians. You've cheated them." When the Indians saw the sun coming with the blankets, they smiled and said, "We knew you'd be back. Jacob Hamblin never cheated an Indian." Many of you may have seen placards on the classrooms of this university containing a quotation from Joseph Smith, which reads, "Make honor the standard of all men." Many of you may not know that that statement comes from the political platform on which Joseph Smith aspired to be President of the United States. In that platform, some 16 years before the outbreak of the Civil War, Joseph Smith urged, "Abolish the practice in the Army and Navy of trying men by court-martial for desertion. If a soldier or Marine runs away, send him his wages with this instruction, that his country will never trust him again, that he has forfeited his honor. Make honor the standard with all men." We therefore congratulate you as a student body on making honor the standard of all men. It follows in this school that if a student violates his word or breaches the code of honor, we will have this to say to him: "You have not been honorable with yourself, and in the interest of the honor of this institution, we will have to discharge you and make your dishonorable conduct known." And in some flagrant cases, the administration may have to say, as the Prophet Joseph said, "This school will never trust you again. You have forfeited your honor. You shall no longer pollute the halls of this sanctuary." Now, we know that in a student body of 10,000, there are certain to be some who cannot measure up to our standards. The obligation for the rest of us is that we not tolerate such conduct, for it's unbecoming any student. For we know that adherence to standards of integrity and honesty at this student body is high. As one example, I'm happy to report to you that during this last school year, the students of this university found and turned into the Lost and Found Department some 8,451 articles having an estimated value of over $53,000. The Honor Council is to be commended for its desire to have the Honor Code executed in an honorable way by honorable students. We give it as an administration and as a faculty our complete support. May you, as students, through prayer, through self-restraint, make it the best administered code in our country. If you are tempted at any time to cheat, please remember the charge of Carl G. Mazur. "My young friends," he said, "I've been asked what I mean by word of honor. I will tell you. Place me behind prison walls, walls of stone ever so high, ever so thick, reaching ever so far into the ground. There's a possibility that in some way or another I may be able to escape. But stand me on the floor and draw a chalk line around me and have me give my word of honor never to cross it. Can I get out of that circle? No, never. I'd die first." In that way, I suggest that we will maintain the maxim of George Washington, who wrote, "I hope I shall possess firmness and virtue enough to maintain what I consider the most enviable of all titles, the character of an honest man." May God bless each of us that this year on this campus, through administration of the honor code by the students, we may give to the outside world as well as to ourselves the greatest example of honesty and integrity of any student body in the world. And I ask this in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. Amen.